Chapter 22, Holy Places and Eminent Buddhists. By the end of the 13th century, Buddhism had almost disappeared from India as an organized religion. Assimilation by Hinduism, withdrawal of royal patronage, centralization of learning in grand monastic universities, and the destruction of those universities by Muslim invaders from the northwest had all played a part in the process, though the relative importance to be attributed to each of these factors remains a matter of dispute among scholars. During the next 600 years, the situation did not greatly change, so that when India achieved independence in 1947, Buddhist communities were to be found only in the border areas, principally those in the north, Ladakh and Himachal Pradesh, and in the northeast, Sikkim, Assam, and the Northeast Frontier Agency. As part of the Buddha Jayanti celebrations, some 50 representatives of these communities had been invited to tour the Buddhist holy places as guests of the Government of India, and to spend 4 days in Delhi in the same capacity. Among the eminent Buddhists from border areas, as the invitees were officially designated, were two from Kalimpong, in the persons of Dala Rinpoche and me, for both of us had by that time resided in the town long enough and played a sufficiently prominent part in its Buddhist activities to be regarded as the de facto representatives of the place's rather heterogeneous Buddhist population. The tour started from Calcutta, and it was outside the National Tourist Office in that city that we all assembled on the morning of the 29th of October. Many of those who gradually filled the little compound were monks. There were shaven-headed, yellow-robed bhikkhus from West Bengal and Assam, none of them unfortunately known to me, and shaven-headed, red-robed lamas from Ladakh and NEFA. Besides long-haired, red-robed figures from some indeterminate border region, who may or may not have been monks and who presented, in some cases, a rather fantastic appearance. There are also laymen in a variety of national and regional costumes, from Nepalese coat and jodhpurs to Tibetan-style kaftan. Some of my fellow eminent Buddhists were bewildered, even disoriented, by the experience of being suddenly plucked from a remote village or monastery and set down in the heart of the biggest city of India, especially as they knew neither Hindi nor English, and could communicate, in a few cases, only in their own local dialect. This meant that the stylish young Bengali woman who was in charge of the tourist office, and responsible apparently for getting us to Howrah Station, did not have an easy time ascertaining their identities and inducing them to board one of the waiting buses. At times, indeed, she was reduced to darting hither and thither, sari end floating out behind her, pushing and shoving the more uncomprehending of them in the direction she wanted them to go, an unceremonious proceeding to which the more elderly and conservative among them clearly took exception. Eventually, however, she succeeded in getting everyone on board, and half an hour later, we were being offloaded at the station and escorted to the special train that was to take us to the holy places and which was to be our home for the duration of the pilgrimage. In the course of the next week, we visited Bodh Gaya, Rajgir, Nalanda, Sarnath, Kusinara, Lumbini, Sanchi and Agra, as well as seeing two or three of the enormous dams the government was constructing as part of one of its ambitious hydroelectric power schemes. What with the time it took the train to get from one pilgrimage centre to another, and the time it took the coach to convey us from the railway station to the temple or archaeological site that was our objective, we rarely were able to spend more than an hour or two at any of the holy places we visited, with the result that in most cases my impressions of them are not very distinct. Of some of the most important holy places, including Bodh Gaya, I have indeed no recollection at all, at least so far as the present pilgrimage is concerned. My only really vivid recollections are of Sarnath and Kusinara, and these are recollections not so much of the places themselves as of certain incidents that took place in them, one of which was ultimately to affect the whole course of my life and thought as a Buddhist and as a monk. As for the dams we were taken to see, my only recollection of these is of standing in front of one of them with Dada Rinpoche, and his shaking his head and remarking with a smile, "Such things don't really solve the problem of human suffering." If the organisers of the tour had hoped that the eminent Buddhists from the border areas would be no less impressed by the temples of modern India, as Pandit Nehru was fond of calling dams and power stations, than they were by the ruined shrines of the ancient Buddhist holy places, then they were doomed to disappointment. Sarnath was one of the four principal places of Buddhist pilgrimage, together with Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, and Kusinara, the Buddha having preached there to his five former companions, what had come to be known in English as his first sermon, but which was much more likely to have been more of the nature of an informal talk. In the course of the last 7 years, I had visited Sarnath at least four or five times, more than once staying there for a few days, and was familiar with its excavated area, dominated by the massive bulk of the Dhammek stupa, its two or three modern temples or monasteries, its archaeological museum, and its Birla Dharamsala, or Pilgrim's Rest House, as well as with the half-dozen Sinhalese bhikkhus who ran the Mahabodhi Society's activities there, and cared for the Mula Gandakuti Vihara, the pink sandstone temple built by Anagarika Dhammapala in the late 20s and early 30s. Since my last visit, much had been done in the way of improvement. Lawns and flower beds had been laid out, giving the whole place a serene, park-like appearance. And beyond the excavated area, not far from the Mula Gandakuti Vihara, a deer park had been created, Sarnath having been, in the Buddha's day, a place of refuge for deer and other wild creatures. As soon as we had paid our respects to the Dhammek stupa, which, according to an ancient inscription, marked the exact spot where the Buddha had delivered the first sermon, or in traditional parlance, turned the wheel of the Dharma, Dada Rinpoche and I, and the rest of the eminent Buddhists, were led to the Mula Gandakuti Vihara. Here, a reception by Venerable Sangharatana and his yellow-robed colleagues awaited us. Before it could begin, there was a point of protocol to be settled. The Vihara consisted of a spacious rectangular hall, the walls of which were covered with frescoes, with a kind of chapel at the far end. The floor of the chapel, which contained a life-sized gilded image of the Buddha, was a foot or so higher than the floor of the hall. On entering the Vihara, the bhikkhus in our party automatically went and sat inside the chapel, where the Mahabodhi Society bhikkhus were already seated, leaving the lamas to occupy the floor of the hall, along with the laity. Some of the lamas, as Sonam Topge Kazi, the Sikkim representative, was not slow to point out to Venerable Sangharatana, were, however, celibates, like their Theravadin counterparts. Would it not therefore be better, he politely inquired, if these lamas sat inside the chapel with the bhikkhus, rather than in the hall with him and the other lay members of the party? As I knew from my own acquaintance with him, Sangharatana was more open-minded than most Theravadin monks, and I was not surprised when, after he had briefly consulted with his colleagues, the celibate lamas were invited, to their evident satisfaction, to sit with the bhikkhus on the higher, more honourable level. On the opposite side of the excavated area from the Mula Gandakuti Vihara stood the modest structure that was the Burmese temple. It was in this temple, almost exactly 6 years earlier, that I had received my bhikkhu ordination, and I naturally did not want to leave Sarnath without visiting the place, paying my respects to the resident monk, Yu Kittima, and renewing my commitment to the monastic life. When entering the compound, I saw a number of Burmese pilgrims, all in national costume and smoking cheroots, and either strolling about or squatting on their heels beneath the big shady trees. But there was no sign of Yu Kitima, and no one seemed able or willing to tell me where he was, or even if he was on the premises at all. At length there emerged from the servants' quarters the Brahmin woman, who, as I knew, was Yu Kitima's cook, and the young man, her son, who acted as the temple manager. As soon as she recognised me, the woman uttered a great cry and threw herself at my feet. "Babaji wanted to throw her out, and her son out," she exclaimed, bursting into a flood of tears. She had served him faithfully for 20 years and more. She had been a good wife to him, and now he wanted her and her boy to leave the place. Where would they go? What would they do? Would I please write to Big Babaji in Kusinara and ask him to tell Babaji not to turn her out? Would I speak to Babaji himself, who for the last 2 or 3 weeks had been staying in Benares, and who had vowed not to return until she was gone? "You all know Babaji and I were living together," she pleaded. "You all know my son is his son too. Please help us." I had not known that Yu Kitima's cook was also his concubine, though his brother Bhikkhus in Sarnath and Kusinara had evidently been privy to what was going on. Nor had I known that the young man in the lungi, who acted as the temple manager, was the Burmese monk's son, though when I looked at him, as he stood there beside his mother, arms stoically folded, the resemblance was obvious. The distraught woman's revelations therefore came as a complete surprise to me, and for some minutes I did not know what to say, especially as several eminent Buddhists who wanted to see more of Sarnath had accompanied me to the Burmese temple from the Mulagandakuti Vihara, and were clearly wondering what was amiss. There was no question of my writing to Big Babaji, whom I was in any case hoping to meet the following day when the party visited Kusinara, and who, of course, was none other than Yu Chandramani, from whom I had received my Shamanera or novice ordination in 1949. Neither was there any question of my speaking to Yu Kitima, whom I had always regarded as being very much my elder brother in the monastic order. When I had recovered from my astonishment, I therefore simply assured the discarded cook concubine of my sympathy, and expressed the hope that Babaji would change his mind and allow her to stay, after which I left the Burmese temple without having renewed my commitment to the monastic life, and in a state of considerable perplexity. That taciturn, scholarly Yu Kitima was, as it appeared, a layman in the guise of a monk, was not a matter that concerned him alone, or even one that concerned only him and the unfortunate woman he now wanted to dismiss from his service. It was a matter that concerned the whole Theravadin monastic order, or at least that branch of it to which he and I both belonged. It was certainly a matter that concerned me personally. Yu Kitima had been present at my bhikkhu ordination. He had taken part in it, sitting inside the simha, or consecrated area, with the other members of the ordaining chapter. It was he who, as presiding monk of the Burmese temple, had signed my ordination certificate, testifying that I was, quote, properly ordained as a bhikkhu according to the Vinaya of Theravadi bhikkhus, unquote. If, at the time of my ordination, he was a layman in the guise of a monk, and if, as I had been told, the presence of such a person inside the simha as a member of the ordaining chapter invalidated the proceedings, then my ordination was technically null and void, and I was not in fact a bhikkhu. What, then, was I? Well, I was certainly not a layman in the guise of a monk in the way that Yu Kitima was. I was technically a layman nonetheless, in that, according to the Vinaya, I was neither bhikkhu nor shamanera, and there was no fourth category of male ecclesiastical persons to which I could belong. Yet I did not feel myself to be a layman. I was as much committed to the spiritual life and to being a monk as I had been before that fateful visit to the Burmese temple, and did not have the slightest wish to return to the life of the world. Indeed, I knew myself to be more committed to the spiritual life and to being a monk in the true sense than were many bhikkhus of my acquaintance, technically valid though their ordinations may have been. But if according to the Vinaya I was neither bhikkhu nor shamanera, and if I did not feel myself to be a layman, then what was the basis of my commitment to the spiritual life? What was it that enabled me to live as a monk and work for the good of Buddhism? Such were the questions that passed through my mind as I rejoined my fellow eminent Buddhists and boarded the coach that was taking us back to Benares, and it was to be many years before I found a satisfactory answer to them. Meanwhile, I had no alternative but to live as though I had, in fact, been validly ordained and was a bhikkhu in the technical Vinaya sense. Kusinara was about 150 miles from Benares, and if we did not see the site of the Buddha's parinirvana, or final passing away, the following day, we certainly saw it the day after that. Like Sarnath, it had been much improved since my last visit, and as that visit had occurred in 1949, there were even more changes for me to take note of than in Sarnath. In my eyes, not all the changes counted as improvements. The brand new temple with the big Ajanta-style horseshoe windows that now house the ancient 30-foot-long recumbent image of the Buddha was no doubt a fine building, but it entirely lacked the atmosphere of the primitive structure, hardly bigger than the image itself, in the gloom of which, 7 years ago, Buddhavacharya and I had meditated each morning with only two or three flickering candles between us and the enormous face of the dying master. Other changes were even less welcome. The half-crazy Chinese monk who lived in a peepal tree and who burned candles on different parts of his body had come down from his tree. But he had not only come down, he had built himself a cottage and was even now building a kitchen onto the cottage with bricks taken from inside the exposed rim of the newly excavated Angiya Chajja, the mound marking the spot where the earthly remains of the Buddha had been cremated. A party of coolies was busy dislodging hundreds of bricks with crowbars and removing them in baskets. When some of us went and complained to the archaeological department overseer, he flatly denied that anything of the sort was happening, whereupon we insisted on his accompanying us to the spot and seeing with his own eyes what the coolies were doing. Either there had been gross negligence on somebody's part, or somebody had been bribed. Whichever it was, serious damage had been done to an ancient and important Buddhist monument. Though Kusinara had been much improved since my last visit, few changes had taken place in the dimly lit, sparsely furnished ground floor room where Buddhavacharya and I had been favoured with our first interview with U Chandramani, and where my former preceptor now received as many of the eminent Buddhists as could be squeezed into the limited space. Very little was said, conversation being hardly practicable in the circumstances, and the visitors being for the most part content, in any case, simply to sit there and have the old man's darshan. At one point, however, as he slowly surveyed the different faces of the room, U Chandramani's gaze fell upon me. "Is it Sangharakshita?" he asked wonderingly, as if unable to believe his eyes. I confirmed that it indeed was, but though he seemed pleased to see me, there was no further exchange between us. We had not met for 7 years. For my part, though I was pleased to see him, and though the occasion brought back poignant memories of my Samanera ordination at his hands, the Brahmin woman's plea for help still rang in my ears, and I was uncomfortably aware that U Chandramani too had known of U Kittima's liaison with her, and had therefore been, in a sense, a party to it. Despite his 80 years, he still presented a fairly robust appearance as he sat there, cross-legged, on the same old cane-bottomed armchair. But his face was more deeply furrowed, and the flesh hung a little more loosely on his bones. He also looked a little tired. This was not surprising. he had not long returned from an exhausting trip to Madhya Pradesh, where, on the 14th of October, in Nagpur, he had formally initiated Dr. Ambedkar and his wife into Buddhism, after which the scheduled caste leader had himself administered the three refuges and five precepts, together with 22 vows of his own devising, to more than a quarter of a million of his followers, thus inaugurating the movement of mass conversion of untouchables to Buddhism. Before taking leave of Uchandramani, the eminent Buddhists at Sonam Topge's whispered suggestion dug into pockets and shoulder bags, with the result that we were able to place at his feet a small pile of currency notes. Lumbini was not in India but in Nepal, so that in order to reach it, one had to cross the border, but apart from having my photograph taken with Dada Rinpoche in front of the pillar that marks the spot where the Blessed One was born, I remember nothing of our visit to the place. I do have a vivid recollection, however, of the evening the Rinpoche and I spent at Gorakhpur, where our special train was kept at the station for two nights in a siding, and whence we were conveyed by coach first to Kusinara and then to Lumbini. Gorakhpur was an old-fashioned town with, it appeared, a predominantly Hindu population. At least that was the impression we formed as we made our way to the bazaar area, for there was a Hindu festival in progress and everybody was taking part. Night had fallen and the houses and open-fronted shops and the innumerable little wayside stalls were all lit not by electricity but by the soft golden glow shed by myriads of tiny oil lamps. Despite the fact that a festival was being celebrated, there was little noise, and an atmosphere of deep peacefulness prevailed. As though in a dream filled with the smell of incense and crushed flowers, we drifted down by-lane after by-lane and from stall to stall. Many of the stalls were selling beautifully painted and decorated wooden or clay figures a few inches high. Who or what the figures represented, or whether they had a connection with the festival, we did not know, any more than we knew what the festival itself was all about. Nor did we want to know. I myself was perfectly content simply to observe the scenes through which we passed, taking in colour, shape and movement, as it were, for their own sake, without thinking about what I saw. Quote, in the scene, only the scene, in the herd, only the herd, etc. End quote. Though we obviously were strangers to the town, nobody accosted us or tried to sell us anything, or bothered us in any way. It was almost as though we were invisible, so that we returned to the train well pleased with our nocturnal outing, and favourably impressed by Gorakhpur. By this time the tour was more than half over, and something like a friendship had begun to develop between Dada Rinpoche and me, as well as between the pair of us and the two other occupants of our compartment. These were Sonam Topge Kazi and S. Yonzoni. Sonam Topge was a friend of the French nun, in fact, the same Kazi friend who had come to see me in Gangtok on the first of my recent visits to the village capital. Small, light-complexioned, and invariably attired in the traditional tuba, he worked as a translator in Apa Pant's office, where he had acquired a reputation, I afterwards learned, for elusiveness. Though broad in his Buddhist sympathies, he was a convinced follower of the Nyingma tradition, and the personal disciple of some of its most distinguished living masters. It was from him, in the course of one of our many conversations during the tour, that I first heard of Dzogchen, the highest Nyingma teaching. He possessed, in fact, a good general knowledge of Tibetan Buddhism, and was acquainted with learned lamas of every school. In Benares, he had taken me to see a Gelug Lama, whom he particularly esteemed, both for his learning and his asceticism. We found the Lama, whose name was, I think, Sherab Gyaltsen, occupying a tiny whitewashed room, whose sole contents were a mat, two or three Tibetan books, and a small tin suitcase that served him as a desk. He was overjoyed to see us, and with Sonam Topke as interpreter, he and I were able to have a short conversation. All he wanted to do was study, he told me enthusiastically, his eyes shining. It was in order to study that he had come to Benares, as, despite his advanced age, I judged him to be about 50, he wanted to learn Sanskrit. On our taking leave of him, he looked round the room for something to give me, but there was nothing there. Whereupon he looked inside the tin suitcase, but except for a few dried apricots, it was empty. But he was not to be defeated. As though seized by a sudden inspiration, he broke the string of his rosary and gave me a bead, saying, "Many millions of mantras have been said on this bead. Please accept it with my blessing." The fourth member of our quartet, S. Yonzoni, was a Tamang schoolmaster from Kersiong, with whom I was already acquainted as a result of the visits I had paid to that place. Like Sonam Topke, he was about my age, but unlike that staunch traditionalist, he preferred Western dress, as did most English-educated young Nepalis in the Darjeeling area. For the purpose of the tour, however, he had decked himself out in a light blue coat and jodhpurs, complete with a black conical cap. Though a Tamang, and therefore technically a Nyingmapa, he knew little or nothing about the Nyingmar tradition, or, for that matter, about any form of Buddhism. Consequently, he did not find it easy to join in the doctrinal discussions with which Dada Rinpoche, Sonam Topke, and I passed the time between holy places. And when he did join in, it was usually only to reveal an ignorance and a confusion that would have been laughable had they not been so lamentable. But though not very bright, he was sincere and well-meaning, and in the course of the tour, the three of us did our best to inculcate a few basic Buddhist ideas and to clear up at least some of his confusion. Occasionally, our quartet received a visit from Dondup Lendup, the leader of the NEFA contingent, who had studied with me for a few months in Kalimpong in the days when I was living as the guest of Burma Raja, and whose good looks had been much admired by Marco Palace. Since then, he had graduated, joined the Indian Administrative Service, and been posted to a subdivision in the depths of NEFA. There, I had heard, he exercised despotic sway, enjoying unlimited access to the local liquor and the local women. Absolute power had corrupted absolutely. The first time he appeared in the doorway of the compartment, I hardly recognised him. Gone were his looks. He had put on weight, his eyes were bloodshot, his gaze dull and vacant. In the crumpled navy blue suit he was wearing, he looked more like a middle-aged man, though he could not have been more than 30. When I told Marco Palas a few years later about the change that had taken place in my old pupil, he was quite distressed and exclaimed, "Oh, he was so good-looking." Whenever the eminent Buddhists were ferried from a railway station to a holy place, Dada Rinpoche and I would sit together in the middle section of the coach. Initially, this occasioned astonishment, even indignation, on the part of the yellow-robed members of the party. Like most Theravadin bhikkhus, they were great observers of protocol, and the first time we had to board a coach, which must have been when we visited Bodh Gaya, they made sure that they got on first and occupied the front seats. Their red-robed counterparts, on the contrary, motioned others to precede them with a smile, "After you." When we were all on board, the leader of the Assam bhikkhus turned round in his seat, saw me sitting with Dada Rinpoche a few rows back, and called out, "Come and sit in the front with us. You're a bhikkhu too." But I stayed where I was, and as I sat with Rinpoche for the rest of the tour, he and the other bhikkhus eventually concluded that I was a renegade from their ranks, and could not be relied on to help them maintain the prestige of the Theravadin monastic order. From our position halfway down the coach, my companion and I could not only see what was going on in front of us, but hear what was going on behind. Often we heard squeals and scuffles. These sounds came from the back seat, which extended for the entire width of the coach. In the middle of this seat, facing the aisle, sat a stout, youngish woman who, we had been told, was a Bhutanese nun. She wore a short, apron-like skirt that barely reached to her knees, leggings, a little jacket, and a conical hat with a feather in it, and her round, rosy face was always wreathed in smiles. On each side of her sat two or three shaven-headed, red-robed lamas. Every now and then one of the lamas would pinch her plump thigh, hence the squeals, whereupon she would turn in his direction and try to give him a slap, hence the scuffles. While she was thus engaged, a lama on the other side would pinch the other thigh, whereupon she would turn round and try to hit him. Everyone seemed to enjoy this little game, including the dignified Bhutanese abbess, said to be a relation of the king, who, from a seat nearby, regarded the proceedings with an indulgent smile. At any rate, both the lamas and the nun enjoyed it sufficiently to play it every time we were in the coach for more than a few minutes. Friendship implies a degree of mutual knowledge, and the fact that something like a friendship had begun to develop between Dada Rinpoche and me meant that we had got to know each other better. In Kalimpong, this had hardly been possible, as we met only at intervals and usually on some formal occasion. Moreover, we were both rather reserved, whether by nature or as a result of having had, in his case, a Gelug monastic training, in mine an English upbringing. Nonetheless, each had definite feelings of goodwill towards the other, while from my side there was an appreciation of the Rinpoche's unusual qualities. That appreciation naturally increased during the tour, as well as in Delhi afterwards, when the fact that we were constantly together meant that I got to know him much better than before, even as he, no doubt, got to know me better. Though he had many positive qualities, the two that impressed me most were his uniform kindness and generosity, and his unfailing mindfulness. The latter consisted not only in an entire absence of anything resembling forgetfulness or inattentiveness, but also in a degree of foresight and preparedness that was almost supernatural. In later years, I was to say that Dada Rinpoche was never caught napping. On the tour itself, there occurred an incident which strikingly exemplified this quality of his. The officials who were responsible for looking after the party and organising its transport used to tell us each morning which places we would be visiting that day. One morning they told us we would be visiting a certain dam in the morning, and in the afternoon, after returning to the train for lunch, a certain holy place. Unfortunately, there was somehow a mix-up. An hour after leaving the train, we found ourselves not at the dam, as we had expected, but at the holy place. This in itself did not really matter, but thinking we would not be needing them until the afternoon, none of us had brought any candles or incense sticks. None of us, that is, except Dada Rinpoche. As we were lamenting the fact that we would be unable to offer worship in the proper manner, he produced packets of candles and bundles of incense sticks from beneath his voluminous robes and smilingly distributed them among us. Strange to say, there proved to be enough candles and enough sticks of incense for everyone. If Sarnath meant the Dhammic stupa, and Kusinara the colossal image of the recumbent Buddha, then Agra, our last stop before Delhi, meant the Taj Mahal. It was the first time either Dada Rinpoche or I had seen that, quote, one solitary tear hanging on the cheek of time, as Rabindranath Tagore characterised Shah Jahan's masterpiece. Having seen so many photographs and paintings of the famous monument, not to mention the plastic models that were on sale at every railway station. I was more than half afraid that the beauty of the original had been spoiled for me and that I would be disappointed. Nor was it really to be expected that any building on earth could live up to the superlatives that had been heaped upon the Taj Mahal. In the event, I was not disappointed. The Taj Mahal far exceeded my expectations. It was incomparably more beautiful than I had imagined it to be. It was also very much bigger. The perfect proportions of the building and its flanking minarets, as shown in 100 pictures, had led me to think of it as small and dainty. But as the Rinpoche and I walked along from the high red sandstone gateway along one of the paths bordering the long watercourse, in whose depths it was reflected, it grew steadily bigger until eventually the dazzling white marble mass loomed over us, almost blotting out the blue sky. Inside it was cool and comparatively dark, especially in the crypt containing the actual tombs of the woman in whose memory the Taj Mahal had been built and the grieving emperor who had built it. A few months later, recalling the visit, I composed a quatrain in which the love and death, Eros and Thanatos, that were everything inside the crypt, were contrasted with the life and hate that seemed to be everything outside it. The fact was that I had visited the Taj Mahal at the time of the Suez Canal crisis, when voices prophesying war, ancestral and other, could be heard on all sides. But it was not only the prospect of war which dismayed me. I was also dismayed by India's adoption of the double standard. I had not expected this. Had there not been an ethical dimension to the freedom struggle, and had not independent India so far shown a marked tendency to occupy the moral high ground in international affairs? Yet here was Pandit Nehru, the Prime Minister, vigorously condemning the Anglo-French action in Egypt, while at the same time responding to Soviet Russia's invasion of Hungary and its crushing of that country's nascent reform movement, simply with a mild expression of concern. India's foreign policy, it seemed, was in reality no more guided by moral considerations than was that of less Pecksniffian nations. On our way back to the station from seeing the Taj Mahal and the Agra Fort, a strange thing happened. Dada Rinpoche and I both saw the words Buddha Vihara on the end of a small roadside building. This was not strange in itself, even though none of the other eminent Buddhists on the coach saw them. What was strange, as we discovered afterwards when we compared notes, was that whereas the Rinpoche had seen the words in Roman script, I had seen them in Devanagari. Obviously, we ought to investigate, for where there was a Buddha Vihara, there were bound to be Buddhists, and we had not expected to find any Buddhists in Agra. As none of our eminent Buddhist colleagues was willing to accompany us, some of them indeed being of the opinion that both the Rinpoche and I had only thought we saw the magic words, the two of us got into a rickshaw and set off on our own. Finding the route taken by the coach did not prove easy, and it took us a long time to locate the area in which the building we sought was situated. But eventually we did so, and there it was, and there were the words Buddha Vihara in both scripts. It was a rather nondescript building and consisted of little more than a single chamber and a veranda. Peering through the grille and the wooden doors, we saw inside a Buddha image of the traditional Burmese type. A Hindu temple had evidently been turned into a Buddhist place of worship. As there was no one to be seen, it being by that time about 10 o'clock and very dark, I seized the rope of the large bell that hung Hindu style inside the veranda and gave it several sharp tugs, producing a corresponding number of loud clangs. Soon, several dozen poorly dressed men, women and children from the nearby hutments had gathered on the veranda. Despite the presence of the Buddha image on the shrine, which an elderly man now opened, they seemed uncertain whether they were Buddhist or not, nor did they know much about Buddhism. though I gathered that a few of the men had attended Dr. Ambedkar's mass conversion ceremony in Nagpur the previous month. Though surprised by our sudden appearance in their midst, especially at such an hour, they were pleased to see us, and pleased when I gave them a 20-minute impromptu talk on Buddhism. Dada Rinpoche and I therefore returned to the station well satisfied with the success of our expedition and glad we had followed our instinct in the matter. In Delhi, the eminent Buddhists were guests of the Government of India for 4 days, after which we were expected to shift for ourselves. Some of us found shelter at the local branch of the Mahabodhi Society and at the Ashok Vihara, Mehrauli, which had been founded by Venerable Veera Dhammavira, the Cambodian monk I had met in Calcutta the previous year, but which an English woman married to a well-known Indian communist was trying to wrest from his control. During the days that we were still government guests, we continued to live on our special train, whence we were conveyed each day not to a Buddhist holy place or a dam, but to a meeting or reception. Our first meeting was with the President of India, Dr. Rajendra Prasad, and it took place at his official residence, Rashtrapati Bhavan, the palace-like building that had once been the Viceroy's house. As it was his government that had invited us to tour the holy places as its guests, we naturally wanted to express our gratitude for the invitation to Dr. Prasad, and I had been elected to perform this office on everybody's behalf. Besides thanking him, I made a number of requests. These requests had been agreed among the eminent Buddhists beforehand, and related to such matters as facilities for worship at the Vajrasana in Bodh Gaya, the acquisition of land in Bodh Gaya by border area Buddhist organisations, the protection of the Angya Chaitya in Kusinara, and the provision of scholarships for Tibetan-speaking border area Buddhists who wish to study Sanskrit, Hindi and Pali. To all our requests, Dr. Prasad gave a sympathetic response, promising to refer them to the appropriate authorities. Only one request did he reject, and that was made not by me, but by the leader of the Assam Bhikkhus. Seeing the president was in what he must have thought was an indulgent mood, he asked if he and his fellow bhikkhus could stay on in the capital as the government's guests and at its expense for an extra 2 weeks. Dr. Prasad could not help smiling at this absurd request and, stroking his walrus moustache, replied as gently as he could that he did not think that would be possible, whereupon the bhikkhu sat down looking crestfallen and discomforted. When I made the requests on which we had all agreed, I noticed that as soon as I mentioned Bodh Gaya, the president stiffened in his seat and his expression, hitherto kindly, became grave. He evidently thought I was about to raise the vexed question of the Bodh Gaya temple, control of which the Buddhists had been demanding since the time of Anagarika Dhammapala. But I knew it was unwise to ask for something the other party would never give, especially when the asking was likely to cause offence. Devapriya Valasinha had told me that Rajendra Prasad, though not a Brahmin, was a staunch Hindu, and that in pre-independence days, when he was president of the Indian National Congress, he had once approached him regarding the Bodh Gaya temple. In the course of the interview, Prasad warned him that if the Mahabodhi Society persisted in campaigning for Buddhist control of the temple, he would personally lead a counter-campaign and see to it that the Buddhists had no say at all in its affairs. People seemed to feel strongly about the Bodh Gaya temple, but while it was natural that Buddhists should want to be in control of their own holiest shrine, it was difficult to understand why Hindus should want to hold on to a place that had come into their possession as a result of a series of historical accidents. When it became clear that I was not going to raise the Bodh Gaya temple question, the president relaxed and his face resumed its previous kindly, almost fatherly expression. At our meeting with the Vice President, Dr. S. Radhakrishnan, We had no requests to make, and he did practically all the talking. Indeed, he treated us to a glib homily on the subject of the inseparability, even the unity, of pranya and karuna, wisdom and compassion, which Sonam Topke translated into Tibetan for the benefit of the Tibetan-speaking delegates, and over which they afterwards shook their heads. That a non-Buddhist layman should take it upon himself to address Buddhists, including lamas, on one of the profoundest Mahayana teachings, struck them as extremely odd. When we met Pandit Nehru, there was neither requests from us nor any lecture from him. Dr. Rajendra Prasad had received us in a sort of throne room, sitting on a dais and flanked by uniformed ADCs and attendants in scarlet tunics. At the meeting with Dr. Radhakrishnan, there had been much less formality, the vice president receiving us in his drawing room and addressing us from an easy chair. At Pandit Nehru's house, where we were given lunch and met Indira Gandhi and her two young sons, Sanjay and Rajiv, there was no formality at all. After the lunch, for which we sat Indian style at individual small tables decorated with flowers, Pandit Nehru took me into the garden to show me the pair of giant pandas he had recently been given by the government of the People's Republic of China. Despite their keeper's enticements, they refused to come down from their eucalyptus tree, and all I was able to see of them was two black and white patches high up amid the grey-green foliage. Much as one might disagree with Pandit Nehru's foreign policy statements, there was no disputing the fact that he was a friendly and charming person and the perfect host. Dr. Radhakrishnan's homily may have occasioned some head-shaking on the part of Tibetan-speaking eminent Buddhists from the border areas, but he at least had attempted to meet us on our own ground. No such attempt was made at the reception we were given by the Hindu organisations of Delhi. The reception took place under a shamiana in the grounds of the Buddha Vihara, the little temple that was part of the Mahabodhi Society's Delhi centre, and a sort of Buddhist annex to the huge Lakshmi Narayan temple next door, both of them having been built, the latter in grand and cakey style, by a philanthropic Hindu millionaire. Evidently, our hosts had decided to take the Buddhist threat seriously. The capital's 7 or 8 leading Hindu scholars and intellectuals had been invited to address us, with the result that we had to sit through more than 2 hours of speeches. There were speeches in Hindi and speeches in English, long speeches and short speeches. But regardless of whether they spoke in Hindi or in English, or for a longer or a shorter time, all the speakers harped on a theme that was only too familiar to me. They all told us, with varying degrees of emphasis, that Buddhism was only a branch of Hinduism, and that there was no difference between the two religions. The Buddha himself had lived and died a Hindu, and his teaching was no more than a restatement of the teachings of the Upanishadic sages. Buddhists were really Hindus, and it was very wrong of them not to want to be included in the Hindu fold, but to want instead to set Buddhism up as a separate, independent religion. They should give up their narrow-mindedness and intolerance, recognise that Buddhism was part and parcel of Hinduism, and allow themselves to be absorbed by the one true universal Hindu Sanatana Dharma. The message had not been repeated more than 4 or 5 times before the eminent Buddhists, together with the other Buddhists in the audience, started becoming restive under the onslaught. There were signs of unease, even of indignation. Eventually, 2 or 3 of my colleagues whispered to me that the Hindus ought not to be allowed to have things all their own way. I therefore sent a note up to the chairman asking if I might reply to the speeches. They were ostensibly speeches of welcome, and thanked the organisers of the reception. Not suspecting anything, he agreed. I began innocently enough. We were grateful to the Government of India for inviting us to Delhi. We were grateful for having been given the opportunity of worshipping in the Buddhist holy places. I did not mention that as non-Hindus we had not been allowed to enter the Vishwanath temple in Benares. And we are grateful to the Hindu organisations of Delhi for having arranged the present reception. All this I said at some length and in the kind of language that was customary on such occasions. But having said it, I changed my tune. When you invite someone to your house for a meal, I told the speakers, you offer them the food that they like. You do not offer them food that for one reason or another is unacceptable to them. For example, you would not offer vegetarian, non-vegetarian dishes. Now, you know very well that Buddhists do not agree that Buddhism is only a branch of Hinduism, or that the Buddha lived and died a Hindu. You know that such ideas are quite unacceptable, even repugnant to them. Yet, having invited us to your house for a meal, so to speak, this is the fare you insist on setting before us. It is not a reception. It is an insult. These words of mine created consternation on the platform. Several speakers started up to protest that they had not intended to hurt the feelings of the Buddhists, while the chairman, who had himself shown signs of unease during some of the speeches, did his best to conclude the proceedings on a conciliatory note. Next morning, a report of the reception appeared on the front page of the Statesman, and though I was not quoted verbatim, the report made it clear that Buddhists did not agree that Buddhism was a branch of Hinduism. Once the meetings and receptions were over, and there were several others, of all of which I have only a faint recollection, the eminent Buddhists from the border areas were free to go their separate ways. Dada Rinpoche and I, and the other two members of our quartet, continued to keep in touch and to go out and about in one another's company. A visit that Dada Rinpoche, Sonam Topge, Yonzon and I made together ended in a way that was not only unexpected, but also amusing and even instructive, as did a visit that Sonam Topge and I made on our own. The first visit took the four of us back to Rashtrapati Bhavan, while the second took the two of us to the Ashoka Hotel, where the foreign delegates to the Buddha Jayanti celebrations had been accommodated. One of the president's ADCs was Yonzon's cousin. This cousin had invited Yonzon for lunch at his quarters, which were in Rashtrapati Bhavan. When the day came, our Kursion friend insisted that the rest of us should accompany him and that we should all have lunch with his cousin. As we had not been invited, Dada Rinpoche, Sonam Topge and I naturally demurred, but Yonzon was so positive that there would be plenty for everybody and that his cousin, with whom he was on the best of terms, would be very pleased to meet us, that in the end, rather against our better judgment, we allowed ourselves to be persuaded. Plump, sleek, smiling, Captain Tamang was indeed pleased to meet us, and an hour passed in light general conversation. But of lunch there was no sign. Half an hour more passed. Still there was no sign of lunch. Eventually, when the atmosphere had become rather strained, Yonzon asked his cousin sotto voce, in Nepali, when he thought lunch would be ready. Captain Tamang replied smoothly that he had not expected so many people, and that the chicken curry his cook had prepared would only be enough for two. "Couldn't we divide it up and make do?" asked Yonzon in desperation. But Captain Tamang was afraid they couldn't. At this point, when Yonzon was sweating with embarrassment, Sonam Topge intervened, also speaking in Nepali. "Obviously there had been a misunderstanding," he said in his usual quiet, courteous tones. But there was no cause for concern. He would be happy to take the two venerable ones into the city and give them lunch at a restaurant. Leaving an apologetic Yonzon and a sleek, still smiling Captain Tamang to enjoy their chicken curry, of which I, at least, would in any case have been unable to partake, we caught an auto rickshaw to Connaught Circus and had a belated lunch at Gaylord's. Over the meal we chuckled good-naturedly at our well-meaning but naive friend's faux pas, and I was reminded of the famous apologue of the town mouse and the country mouse. As Captain Tamang was doubtlessly explaining to Yonzone at that very moment, the city was not the village, and the free and easy behaviour appropriate to backward, out-of-the-way Kaohsiung was out of place in sophisticated, cosmopolitan Delhi. Not long afterwards, it was Topke and I who found ourselves in the position of country mouse, at least so far as political naivety was concerned. We had gone to the Ashoka Hotel to meet Narada Thera, whom we found well pleased with himself for having taught the youthful Muslim bearer not to offer him a banana without first removing the skin, bhikkhus were not allowed to peel their own bananas, and not to offer it without repeating the traditional Pali formula. He had great hopes for the Dhamma in India, he told us. People were very receptive. After we had left Narada Thera, it occurred to me that we ought not to leave the hotel without trying to meet at least some of the delegates from the communist bloc countries. There was a Buryat head lama from Soviet Russia, for instance. Having obtained his and his secretary's room numbers at the reception desk, we made our way upstairs. The two rooms were adjacent to each other. Rather gingerly, we knocked on the right-hand door, which was the head lama's. After a second and a third knock, it opened to reveal a burly layman who looked out at us with an unfriendly, even hostile expression, without saying anything. We had knocked on the wrong door, or rather, we had knocked on the right door, but the right door was the wrong door, the secretary having installed himself in the room supposedly occupied by the head lama, and vice versa. It was an old trick, and we'd been taken in by it. Nonetheless, Sonam Topke asked the burly layman, first in Tibetan and then in English, if it would be possible for us to meet the lama, but he appeared to understand neither language, and after a few minutes shook his head and closed the door. I had also hoped to meet the members of the Buddhist Association of China, but thinking I would probably have no more success with them than Sonam Topke and I had had with the Buryat head lama, I abandoned the idea. In any case, the association was little more than the willing or unwilling tool of Chairman Mao's regime, and its members' principal function, when travelling abroad, was to make, in the name of the Buddhists of China, statements supporting the regime's current position in international affairs. But if I did not meet any Chinese Buddhists, I at least saw a good deal of ancient Chinese Buddhist art. The government of India had sponsored an exhibition of Buddhist art as part of the Jayanti celebrations. Each of the participating countries had its own individual section, the contents of which had been selected and arranged by native experts. One thus was able to see that the Buddhist art of each country possessed a certain distinctive quality, which pervaded all its expressions and was found at all periods. Sikkimese and Bhutanese Buddhist art were usually subsumed under Tibetan Buddhist art, but seeing them in bulk, as it were, both sections took the form of a shrine. I was struck by the extent to which both differed not only from the art of Tibet, but even from each other. Sikkimese art being more, as it were, feminine, Bhutanese art more, as it were, masculine. But, rich and varied though the exhibition was, many of the exhibits not having been seen outside their own country before. Probably the biggest and most striking section was the one devoted to Chinese Buddhist art. And the most striking feature of that section, in my eyes, were the murals from Central Asia, or rather from that part of Central Asia that was now part of the People's Republic of China. I had never seen anything like them, though they were not the originals, but only full-scale copies, and though they reproduced, apparently, the changes that had taken place over the centuries in the colour of the pigments that had been used. Unfortunately, picture postcards were not available, but images of the famous meeting between Mandragosha, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, and the elder Vimalakirti, as described in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, as well as of flying apparatuses, or fairies, and angular Buddhas with extraordinary multicoloured halos lingered in my mind for many years afterwards. It was a far cry from communist China, where Buddhism was in decline, to democratic India, where it was being revived, and where, a month earlier, more than 250,000 people had been converted to Buddhism at a stroke. I had not been able to be present at the ceremony, as my invitation arrived late, when I had already made arrangements to visit Gangtok. Realising the importance of the step Dr. Ambedkar and his followers were about to take, I had, however, sent a message to be read out on the occasion. Quote, "In these days when there is so much lip sympathy for Buddhism and so little real devotion, it is a refreshing and stimulating contrast to find a great national leader boldly breaking away from outworn creeds and obsolete dogmas and openly taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Even if Dr. Ambedkar stood alone today, his conversion to Buddhism would be an event of epochal significance. But he does not stand alone. With him on this historic occasion are tens of thousands of his devoted followers, bent upon emulating his noble example. With him are truth, justice, and compassion. With him, as he stands with his face towards the glorious sun of Buddhism, as once more it rises upon this land, are all those mighty spiritual forces which elevate the human mind and conduce to true progress. With him is the future of India." End of quote. I had also written an editorial about the forthcoming conversions for the October number of the Mahabodhi Journal. The editorial was entitled "The Tide Turns," and in it I sought, inter alia, to remind readers of the background against which the conversions would be taking place. Quote, "Let none think that Dr. B.R. Ambedkar has taken this momentous step hastily or without due consideration," I wrote, "or that he had embarked upon this truly revolutionary course without full consciousness of its socio-religious implications and its far-reaching historical significance. It is perhaps 25 years since Dr. Ambedkar first declared that though he had been born a Hindu, he did not intend to die a Hindu. 25 years is a big enough slice of anybody's life, and a period of time sufficiently long for the pondering even so momentous a step as the changing of one's religion. Brahminical clamours to the contrary notwithstanding, Dr. Ambedkar knows what he is doing, and his followers know what they are doing too. Not theoretical considerations, merely, but their own bitter experience of all the unspeakable cruelty, the soul-searing injustice, and systematic, relentless inhumanity through the ages, has eventually convinced them that Hinduism is incapable of reformation, and that the only course now open to them is to break away from it and embrace Buddhism. Within the Buddhist fold, they will find not only social emancipation, but, what is even more important, a way of life conducive to the attainment both of happiness here and hereafter, and that unshakable deliverance of mind which is the gist of the Buddha's teaching. They will also find the hand of brotherhood stretched out to them from every side, not only welcoming, but assisting and supporting them as they make their first step along the Noble Eightfold Path." End of quote. My own hand was certainly stretched out to them, literally as well as metaphorically. Coming to know that Ambedkar was in Delhi, whither he had returned from Nagpur a few days after the conversion ceremony, I decided to go and see him and personally congratulate him on his great and historic achievement. Most of the eminent Buddhists from the border areas were still in the city, waiting to receive the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama when they arrived at the end of the month, and I was able to persuade them to accompany me, even though many of them had not heard of Ambedkar before and did not know that he had been responsible for the conversion of hundreds of thousands of people to Buddhism. Thus it was, with representatives of several different Buddhist traditions, that I descended one fine morning in the second week of November on Dr. Ambedkar's modest residence in Alipore Road. As there was no room big enough for him to receive us all in, chairs were set out in the compound, and there, in a semicircle, we sat facing our host in the hot sunshine. The scheduled caste's leader, now a Buddhist leader, sat behind a small table, his wife at his side. I saw at once that he was far from well, and that the brown, pear-shaped face beneath the pith helmet looked tired and haggard. So tired and haggard did it look, and so full of suffering the dark eyes, that I apologised for disturbing him, saying that we had come simply to pay our respects and to congratulate him on his conversion to Buddhism. It had been my intention that we should stay no more than 15 minutes, but in the event we stayed 2 hours. Ambedkar was unwilling to let us go. Or rather, he was unwilling to let me go, for it was solely to me that he addressed himself throughout the meeting, to the exclusion of Dada Rinpoche, Sonam Topke, and the rest of the eminent Buddhists. He was a deeply worried man. The movement of mass conversion had been successfully inaugurated, but what of the future? There was still so much to be done. From the way he spoke, sitting there with arms resting on the table and lowered head, it was clear that the weight of his responsibilities had become almost too much for him to bear, and that he wanted to transfer some of that weight to younger shoulders. Indeed, I had the distinct impression that the shoulders to which he wanted to transfer some of it were my own. Be that as it may, the meeting was undoubtedly tiring him. The broken sentences came from his lips with increasing difficulty and at ever longer intervals. Eventually, when his head was already resting on his outstretched arms, his eyes closed in utter weariness, whereupon, to his doctor wife's evident relief, we all quietly left. If Dr. Ambedkar was an old man who had started a new Buddhist movement, the Dalai Lama was a young man who represented an ancient Buddhist tradition. Whereas one was beholding the sun of Buddhism once more rise upon India, albeit amid clouds, the other would see that sun set upon Tibet for no one knew how long. Though it had been known for several months that the government of India had invited the Dalai Lama to attend the official Buddha Jayanti celebrations in Delhi, only in October was it known that he would definitely be coming. Certain obstacles stood in the way, the Chinese authorities had declared, and it would not be possible for His Holiness to leave Tibet. But Pandit Nehru had intervened, the obstacles had been swept aside, and now it was certain that the Dalai Lama would be coming. He would be coming at the end of November, and the Panchen Lama would be coming too. The news was received with great satisfaction by the Indian public, and official and unofficial agencies alike prepared to give the two Grand Lamas a rousing welcome. They arrived in Gangtok on the 24th of November, and the following day the three planes carrying, respectively, the Dalai Lama, the Panchen Lama, and the Maharaja of Sikkim, touched down one after another at Palam Airport, where tens of thousands of people had gathered to receive them. Each in turn was welcomed with the traditional white scarves, inspected a guard of honour, and was introduced to ministers of the central government and members of the diplomatic corps, some of whom also offered scarves. Dalai Lama himself was welcomed by Dr. Radhakrishnan and Pandit Nehru, and when the formalities were over and the last diplomat had been introduced, he advanced towards the waiting bhikkhus. According to the newspapers, Delhi had never seen so many yellow-robed Buddhist monks as were then gathered on the tarmac. There were no red-robed lamas, apparently because the authorities feared they might take advantage of the opportunity to demonstrate against the Chinese occupation of Tibet. The monks came from all the Southeast Asian Buddhist countries, as well as from India itself and from Nepal. There was even a yellow-robed figure from the United Kingdom. The only bhikkhu in Delhi who was not there was Narada Thera. The Dalai Lama was junior to him in monastic ordination, he had declared, and it would be highly improper for him to go to the airport to receive him. The Dalai Lama ought to come to him. None of the other bhikkhus seemed to be in the least bothered about who was junior in ordination and who senior. And as the Dalai Lama drew near, everybody thronged joyfully round the youthful hierarch, catching him by the hands and reciting Pali verses, invoking on him the blessings of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. For several minutes he remained standing there in our midst, blinking in the strong sunlight and smiling, a maroon island in a sea of brilliant saffron. A day or two later, thanks to Sonam Topge, I was able to meet the Dalai Lama privately and to exchange a few words with him. We met at Hyderabad House, where he had been taken from the airport after giving darshan there and making a short speech. It was also at Hyderabad House, I think, that I met him in company with two or three other British Buddhists, one of whom was Christmas Humphreys, founder-president of the Buddhist Society in London, who had recently returned from Kathmandu after attending the fourth conference of the World Fellowship of Buddhists. I had already been to see him in his room at the Ashoka Hotel and had been struck by his extreme coldness. 10 or 12 years ago in London, I had not noticed it. But here in India, where Buddhists and Hindus alike tended to be warm and friendly rather than otherwise, it was very noticeable indeed. Besides being a cold person, the founder-president of the Buddhist Society was a theosophist, not that the two things were necessarily connected, or was at least as much a theosophist as he was a Buddhist. When it was his turn to be presented to the Dalai Lama, he not only sank to his knees in stately fashion, rather as a camel does, but produced a copy of Madame Blavatsky's The Voice of the Silence and asked the Dalai Lama to sign it for him. What was the book? His Holiness naturally wanted to know. It is a Buddhist scripture, Humphreys replied, whereupon the Dalai Lama signed. Years later, when I was again in London, I heard him tell members of the Buddhist Society that the Voice of the Silence was a genuine Buddhist sutra and that the Dalai Lama had personally authenticated it as such. End of chapter 22.